Hello and welcome to World Apart. One dictum that studying history teaches you is that everything works until it doesn't. The brighter the golden age, the darker may be its aftermath, especially when somebody tries to avert the inevitable. With the latest elections in the West more and more vividly demonstrating the voters' disenchantment with the mandated force, what lies ahead for the West and for the rest? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Ian Proud, a former British diplomat and author of A Misfit in Moscow, How British Diplomacy in Russia Failed. Mr. Proud, it's great to see you again. Thank you very much for your time.
Nice to see you again, Oksana. Thanks for inviting me back.
Now, the last time we chatted, it was primarily about the UK's foreign policy stance vis-a-vis Russia, which, borrowing from the title of your book, failed. But today I'm more interested in taking a look at the domestic politics across the West and also in the United Kingdom, because we have had a number of major political events like elections in your own country or in France, the presidential debate in the United States. And I think in all of those, the political establishment is looking rather clumsily. I wonder if you see that as just, unrelated sequence of events, or do you think it signifies some sort of a trend, perhaps the turn of the tide, the political tide?
Well, I mean, there are two aspects of that, I suppose. One is that politics moves in cycles anyway, and what we're seeing in the UK is that just a natural kind of movement of that cycle to sort of get rid of a government that's been in power for 14 years. I think that's kind of, you know, that it flows up and down in terms of kind of more nationalist, more internationalist movements, I tend to think. But, you know, the other aspect is the specific nature of what we see today happening, where there's quite a sharp kind of move away from the kind of consensus, the main political parties in several countries, the UK being one. Obviously, the Labour Party will gain power in the UK, but we're seeing the rise of other more nationalist parties, like the Reform Party, sort of gaining more votes. And of course, in France, on the back of Macron's decision, which could, for the first time, actually kind of hand power, let's see what the second round of voting says, but to Marine Le Pen's nationalist party there. So I think they're sort of in both, a sense of a kind of shift away from kind of mainstream kind of political parties, which aren't really answering the questions people are worried about today on cost of living crisis, on, as far as I'm concerned as an internationalist, on, for example, what's happening in Ukraine and other kind of conflicts around the world. I think there's concern that kind of these traditional parties are not really saying anything different from each other on these big global challenges, which only seem to be getting worse.
Well, but even those parties who are saying slightly different things, they tend to do the same things when they come to power. And, the last time we discussed your book, one of your arguments was that Western elites have become so self-centered and perhaps so arrogant that they couldn't be bothered with studying the reality, you know, establishing facts on the ground, objective facts on the ground, and, making their decisions, whatever they may be, based on those realities on the ground. And I wonder if that applies to domestic politics as well, that, they press a certain course, which may be totally unrooted from what the reality actually calls for.
Yeah, I think that's probably right, Oksana. I think what you also see is that there's less of a separation between kind of state and media now as well. You know, like what you see certainly in the UK in the press, when you talk about Ukraine, for example, something I kind of think about pretty much in every day, there's practically no difference between what all of the two main political parties say and what kind of media say. There's an almost kind of complete cancellation of debate where facts are irrelevant to kind of, you know, the narrative there. And I think what populist parties are doing is they're actually opening debate and they're trying to introduce kind of stuff that the government and the sort of mainstream media aren't really talking about. And I think that's kind of new, particularly because, you know, the people I meet on a day-to-day basis, they, and these are sort of quite middle class, you know, people in good jobs, they have very little real information about what's happening in lots of situations around the world and even in their own country. So I think actually if populism is getting people to talk more about real facts and real events, then I think that's a good thing.
But Mr. Proud, I think there is also, you know, a very important distinction there between, again, preaching and practicing, because it is true that some populist parties are addressing bread and butter issues, but sometimes I get an impression that they are doing that just for the sake of, you know, populism or, you know, provocation. Do you think they actually do you think they actually intend to put that into real policies for the people? Because from all the examples we have had up until now, even with Trump, which was a major example in the United States, you know, getting those ideas realized is a huge challenge. I'm not even sure it's possible.
That's very true. I'll come to the specific Trump point at the end of the answer. But I mean, I think, I think there's a genuine desire to kind of do something different from the mainstream, including on situations like, Ukraine. Nobody's talking about this kind of ridiculous situation where we think the only way to kind of succeed in Ukraine is to send billions and billions and billions of weapons there, and nothing really seems to be improving, and Ukraine is sort of gradually losing. Nobody's talking about an alternative to that, and I think there needs to be that debate. So I think when people like Nigel Farage and others, including Sir Viktor Orban, talk about the need for a negotiated settlement, I think that's a genuine sentiment. I think people genuinely think, well, maybe we need to do something different, you know, there. And I think that's a good thing, then we should encourage that. Now, on Trump, what happens there? I mean, when you go back to his election back in 2016, his coming to power in 2017, what was different then was that actually the political establishment in Washington, including within his own political party, the Republicans, was totally set against him having any improvement of relations with Russia. I think that dynamic may slightly have changed now, where in Congress and, you know, in sort of the media more generally, there's a much more open debate about, well, actually, is this a good idea, just pumping billions of weapons into Ukraine? So I think that dynamic, that political dynamic in Washington, D.C., is different now than it was kind of 8 years ago when, you know, Trump last had an election campaign that he won. So I think you know, if he were to get in power, and let's face it, if Joe Biden stays in the race and that likelihood increases day by day, then I think the political dynamics in DC will be different for Trump. And he would have, I think, more space to have a debate about actually kind of changing the ridiculous status quo in Ukraine.
Now, you mentioned sending weapons to Ukraine, and one budgeting trend we see across the entire West, including the UK, is an increase in military spending, yep, with Russia being used as a primary pretext and its supposed aggressive motives. And that's pretty understandable. After all, there is a conflict raging and Russia is increasing its military spending as well. But one thing the Kremlin is very cautious about is making sure that they're also putting a lot of resources into the quality and availability of public goods so that the public doesn't get too testy. And that's ultimately what the politics has always been about, you know, managing your foreign policy concerns against the domestic challenges. And with Putin, at least, it's very clear. He makes that statement in every of his speeches, that there is a priority of domestic politics above any foreign adventures. Do you think it's the same in the West? Do you think that politicians in the West actually put that priority on the well-being of their own people, not in speeches, but in actual policy?
Well, I mean, there are two aspects to that. Firstly, I mean, certainly if you look at the current election in the UK, that is dominated by domestic issues. No one's really talking about what's happening on the world stage. That's focusing on things like the cost of living crisis.
Yeah, and yet your budget is ballooning, you know?
Yeah, I know. You know, they've made a commitment to increase defence spending to 2.5% of GDP, both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. But the point is, nobody is talking about that. That debate has just been, you know, there isn't a debate. That has just been accepted as given. But the debate itself is really about domestic issues. That's the first aspect of my response to your question. The second aspect is, even though they're not talking about it, are they actually really making us any safer? you know, by having a foreign policy that's actually increasing the likelihood of a much bigger general conflict, you know, in Europe. And I think there, they absolutely aren't helping their domestic constituencies, because even though they refuse to debate it, actually, their policies are actually making our lives much more dangerous. Yes, you know, we're worried about the cost of living crisis, getting appointments in the hospital. I'm far more worried about nuclear war, frankly.
Now, there is an argument in British politics that, you know, your political environment reached its peak back in 2016. I mean, the peak of populism reached with the Brexit vote, and that if the Labour wins this time around, it will signify the return of British political life back to the centre and the bread and butter concerns, which they certainly press rhetorically. But do you actually buy it? Do you think there is sort of this inner momentum within your political elites to actually get to the, you know, mundane and boring work of governance?
Politics is populist. By its nature, democratic politics requires one side to have more votes than the other side. That, by its nature, when was politics ever not populist?
I'm going to take up this issue with you in the next question, but continue with your answer.
That's my first point. But I think we're just stuck in a boring, mundane middle where nobody really has kind of fresh ideas. And I think that's a real problem. And I think actually that may be one of the reasons, going back to what we discussed at the top of this session, why nationalist parties are starting to gain popularity, because, you know, they actually are offering something different. Now, some aspects of what they offer, you know, the anti-immigration and stuff, I personally don't support that because I'm pro-open borders and that sort of thing. But for ordinary bread and butter, you know, folk worried about sort of regular things, they're offering alternative ideas. And I think that is, you know, that is kind of giving them more appeal.
Now, you mentioned a minute ago that politics is populist by definition. And to some extent, I agree with you. And I think we can see that right now playing out in the UK with the sort of a lot of emphasis being put by the Tories on the tactical aspects of voting and trying to get as many voters out to the ballot boxes. And we saw the same thing during the previous election campaign in the United States, with the Democrats going out of their way and, you know, trying to facilitate the procedure to an extent when some concerns about credibility were raised. But, you know, that's done everywhere. But after the ballot boxes or the polls close, you need to get to down to work. That what happens if you have a good leader, because at the end of the day, politics is supposed to be about the delivery of the results rather than the delivery of votes. So I wonder if, again, I guess I'm asking the same question in a different way. Are there enough leaders, from your side at least, who genuinely want to change things around, maybe in a controversial way, but who genuinely want to bring change about, not themselves into the office or their, you know, hidden political interests, but actually change something for the people?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see any kind of genuine, fresh ideas coming from any political party in this campaign. Some areas of interest, I suppose, around giving bodies more independence, like the Office of Budgetary Responsibility and things like that, that actually mirrors what the kind of Tony Blair government did in 1997 when it gave the Bank of England independence, which was one of the best things actually that ever happened, you know, not having sort of government meddling in day-to-day sort of macroeconomic affairs. But in terms of the really big ticket issues, I don't really see any sort of sizable change. You know, the UK is a country with massive debt, largely caused by COVID and the unprecedented support we provided to ordinary people during COVID. But, you know, we have huge debt. We don't have extra money to spend, even though actually, you know, we're spending another 0.5% of GDP on defence, even though nobody's even talking about that. There's no money to kind of come up with some fresh ideas. And nobody likes the idea of cutting public services, you know, cutting civil servants' jobs, making nurses redundant, that sort of thing. So we're kind of stuck. We've got no money. We've got no real ideas. People are just fed up with the Tories, so we're going to end up with a very boring Labour Prime Minister instead. But that doesn't really necessarily signify real change.
Mr. Proud, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez. And I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, Why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Ian Proud, a former British diplomat and author of A Misfit in Moscow, How British Diplomacy in Russia Failed. Mr. Proud, you've been a very active watcher and commentator of the conflict in Ukraine, and we partially discussed already how it may be affected by various political developments in the West, but I want to ask this question specifically. Do you think there will be any change after the results of British or American elections are out?
I don't think there'll be any change on the back of the British elections because, A, you know, the Conservatives and the Labour Party seem to have exactly the same policy, which is a policy not to discuss the ongoing sort of military support to Ukraine. But the second point is we don't really have any power anyway because, you know, policy is almost completely decided by the United States of America. And on that, I think actually... any result from the US presidential election that led to a sort of, you know, Trump, for example, sort of gaining power, you know, could see potentially a shift in posture where he's been quite open in saying that he would stop the war tomorrow, a very Trumpian thing. I mean, you know, whether he could do that is another matter. But I think what he has said is that he would seek to end this kind of nonstop provision of billions and billions, which is having absolutely no effect and only kind of making Ukraine more indebted, losing more territory, losing more lives, you know, from this kind of totally pointless war. So I think, you know, that's what Trump essentially kind of would likely do. So, you know, not that I'm American, I wouldn't really vote either way. But I mean, I think that that will be the key change if it happens if Trump comes to power. And of course, you know, if Biden stays in the race, and that as I said earlier, that likelihood seems to increase every day.
You wrote before that open war between Ukraine and Russia became inevitable as soon as Biden became the 46th president of the United States. Did you reach that conclusion based on Biden's own political worldview or perhaps the lack of thereof?
Well, I mean, you know, Biden was a bit like, you know, George W. Bush when, you know, he sort of launched that illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003. There's a real kind of sense of unfinished business, you know, for George W. Bush, you know, back in 2003. And Biden, when he came to power, for me, it was really all about this really deep-seated feeling that the Democrat Party had been cheated, you know, from an election victory back in 2016 by all this kind of apparent meddling in their internal affairs by the Russian intelligence services and all those kind of things that they were complaining about. And I think that very much kind of bled into his worldview when he came to power. You know, he brought back in the hawks, you know, the Victoria Newlands, the Jake Sullivans, and, you know, people like that who'd been in the wilderness under the Trump. And it's just a complete return to the kind of very hawkish US policy that had been in place, you know, since the start of the Ukraine crisis. So everything that he did, you know, when he came to power, said, well, you know, I've got unfinished business to do with Russia. I don't like sort of Putin. It's all their fault. What's happening in Ukraine? We'll bring the hawks back and we'll go back to square one. And that's where we are today. No further forward.
I'm sure you have caught some glimpses of the US presidential debate. What impression did it make on you?
It was sad. I mean, for any old man, right? I mean, my dad's old. He's actually older than Biden. It's really sad to see, you know, that happened. But actually, you know, the question for me is that has nobody noticed this before, you know, that he's actually an old man and he's the oldest kind of US president going into election campaign. He clearly can't cope anymore. He doesn't have the mental faculties to do it. And that very much came across in the debate. So I think he looked like somebody who was just too old for the job. And actually, the other big question is, well, if he's like that now, what would he be like in 4 years' time if he was still president? that he's not going to be any better then than he is now. Arguably, he's going to be worse. So, I mean, I think actually, as much as the Democrat Party tried to kind of cover over this and say, well, he just had a bad day. We all had have bad days. I mean, I have bad days too. But I think actually it would be a mistake for him to continue.
You know, we all have bad days. And, you know, I think your reference to your dad and, you know, empathy that you may have felt for Biden describing this whole situation as sad, you know, it's understandable on a human level. But I sometimes wonder if it is being exploited, because he is not some old uncle, you know, that you have to sympathize with. He is actually, you know, running for the very powerful office, you know, office that requires a lot of responsibilities, a lot of judgment. And apart from it being an elder, you know, a case of elders abuse, I mean, it's pretty clear that the man is suffering when he stands on that stage. I wonder if sadness is the right emotion here, because at the end of the day, it's not only that, you know, he's being exploited and manipulated, but this whole idea of empathy, why should we empathize with anyone who is running for that kind of office? This person needs to be sharp. He needs to be, you know, fully conscious of both his responsibilities and the risks associated with it. Why is empathy at all relevant here?
Well, we're all humans, aren't we? But I mean, my main concern actually is that, you know, that his policy, you know, since he came to power has been a complete failure, you know, not just in Ukraine and obviously Russia, but in Israel, Gaza. You know, the relationship with China isn't getting any better. North Korea, you know, name me a foreign policy challenge where things have got better under Joe Biden, and I don't think you'd be able to name any, frankly. That's just my personal opinion. So as somebody who thinks about foreign policy on a day-to-day basis, I think he's been a disaster for the US. I think that's just accelerated this kind of discussion, this global discussion about, you know, multipolar world and how that's evolving, you know, and so on and so forth. So, you know, looking at the debate itself, it was a disaster. I mean, as a very hard-hearted kind of analyst looking at the debate, I thought, well, that, you know, if he carries on, that makes it more likely he's going to lose. On that basis, you know, maybe he should continue a bit longer. But I mean, you know, I certainly hope there's a change of U.S. policy. I mean, I'm not saying I'm in favor of Trump, but you know, I certainly hope that Biden's not going to be reelected.
Now, speaking about the U.S. presidential debate, I guess it was sort of predictable, but I think still shocking, the sheer absence of any substantial policy discussion, because I think it was all about I'm the best and you're the worst from both speakers, and none of them really bothered with providing, you know, detailed analysis of what they're going to do or what was wrong with their opponent's policies. Now, I guess it's sort of what the Americans have grown to expect. But what about the British public? Is the level of a debate on par with their expectations of an educated choice?
I think in the UK, if we had, you know, a leader of a political party that was very visibly suffering from the early stages of dementia, then actually...
I'm not sure it's early. I'm not sure it's early at all. I have a relative...
Whatever stage of dementia we're talking about, and I'm a diplomat, not a medical expert, but I mean, I think the political system in the UK would actually kind of move that person out and very gently kind of insist that they kind of retire and actually kind of have a rest in the end of the day. So, but I mean, I personally don't think there's... Yeah, you know, super high quality debate, you know, on policy in the UK either, because, you know, the two mainstream parties are so close together. What they're really arguing about is kind of small things on the edges of what already happens, because they don't have any money to spend to do anything radically new. Nobody can spend a lot more money. Nobody wants to save a lot of money. So they're kind of stuck in this kind of middle ground and kind of arguing. And actually, as I said earlier, what it all comes down to is actually people are fed up with the Conservative Party. They've been in power for too long, and it doesn't matter if Keir Starmer is boring, he's probably going to win anyway.
Well, I think being stuck in the middle ground is not that bad. I mean, at the end of the day, ordinary people are always there, and you do something with the little resources and lots of challenges that you face on a daily basis. And I don't see why the life of politicians should be any different. But
that would be true if we weren't also having no debate about sort of misadventures abroad. You know, if we weren't doing that, I'd agree with you 100%. But unfortunately, we are, and that's making us less safe.
sticking with the British politics, it's true that the last few prime ministers in the UK, I mean, they all had different appearances, but the policies they pursued, or rather they failed to pursue, were pretty much the same. And yet the British politics, maybe just by appearance of it, makes an impression of being more open, or perhaps more representative of a wider political choice. You have a number of parties in the running. What are the chances of London, if not disinvesting itself from this Western, very uniform flow into towards the disaster, but then at least trying to, you know, steer the boat in a way that would maximize its profits, or perhaps minimize the disadvantages for itself?
That would be easier if we had more influence in the world than we have now. I mean, our ability to steer anything has been diminished significantly.
But I'm not asking about even steering the events in the world, steering the events within your own country. I mean, diverting a little bit of that attention, rhetorical attention, towards, you know, domestic issues, that will make you stronger domestically and perhaps produce more revenues as well.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, but the economy is actually starting to look stronger now. Actually, what often happens when a government comes to an end is that a new government inherits it at the time when the economy is just starting to improve and gets an early benefit from the economic growth. So, I mean, that focus on sort of economic growth is an important one. The new Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, I think, will inherit a boat that's in sort of better shape than it was. But there are still massive challenges that we face. And, you know, let's see. I don't want to predict, you know, how well they're going to do. I wouldn't vote for Conservative or Labour anyway, but let's see.
Now, as a Russian, I'm clearly biased and ill-willed towards Western politicians. But if we look at the reactions to the debate, as well as to the general discourse in the West coming from the global South, it's pretty clear that people around the world find this style and the substance of politics quite debased. I wonder what influence do you think it may have on the, you know, international relations more generally?
Well, I think, you know, what's happening certainly with the BRICS grouping is really, really important, because unlike the G7, which is just an exclusive club where they only talk to kind of the most wealthy countries in their kind of Western, US-dominated group, I mean, BRICS is trying to kind of broaden out its discussion to include all countries in the developing world. And I think that's a really interesting area, you know, right now, in terms of actually, you know, making sure that sort of people from Africa, you know, Latin America, you know, parts of Asia are more involved in these kind of big discussions about global financial.
And it's not only about discussions. I think the focus is primarily on practical working projects, something that deliver rather than being something abstract.
Of course it is. But the point is they're involved in that, right? And they have a say. They're not kept out of these kind of small exclusive clubs, you know, like the G7. I think that's an important movement to add. You know, people start to kind of wean themselves off of a belief that we, you know, in the US we trust and we don't need to worry about anything else. And I think, you know, that's what's happening in BRICS, I think, is very much the one to watch over the next kind of two decades.
Well, even if we wanted to trust in the United States, I mean, it's pretty scary to do that.
I mean, well, I'm not saying that I do, but I'm just saying
at the end of the day, I mean, it's sort of the exact reverse of the American soft power. I mean, even if you want to be associated with the West, it's, you know, your own self-preservation instinct doesn't let you do that very easily. Anyway, Mr. Proud, it's been great talking to you as always. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Oksana. Lovely to see you again.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.